Morning. First thing, I will not be here next Monday. So. But I will be here the Monday thereafter, which is Easter Monday. So, I first want to come back to the example we studied last time, and remember, so the example we looked at were extensions of the form group of with two elements and a group with four elements, the Kleinian four group. And so we were discussing what this could look like, and so I want to convince yourself, so here's a claim, that there are indeed eight such classes. And one can make this more precise in the sense, as I said, this has a group structure, so one can actually say it's a group, as a group, an abelian group, it's isomorphic to Z2, three copies of it. But that's not exactly the point. The point is how many classes are there. And as you will see, classifying these extensions will involve a few general facts that will be useful later on when we study extensions in general. And so let me first make a remark or observation. So assume you are given an extension, which I call E, and I'll switch back to the very general framework which we had, so where H, G, K are just groups. And we assume we have a group homomorphism phi. Then we can form what's called phi upper star of E, which is a new extension, and it's going to be an extension of K prime by H, and it's very simple. You simply take the pullback. So in the category of groups, that's just a fiber product, G cross K prime over K. And let me give these morphisms names. So A, B are group homomorphisms, and so this is an exact sequence, of course. So let's call this B prime, let's call this phi prime, and then here, well, B prime, of course, is nothing but the projection onto the second factor from this fiber product. Phi prime is just a projection onto the first factor, and this map here, well, it maps, of course, an element H into the pair A of H, comma, the identity element in K prime. And so the claim is here that phi upper star of E is an extension of K prime by H. Yeah, so remember in general, if you have any morphisms of sets like this, then you can form X cross Y over Z, which is simply going to be the pair of all, so X cross Y over Z is simply going to be the pair of all X comma Y such that F of X equals G of Y. Sorry? So here, I know I'm saying it, so you have given this projection, this epimorphism from G onto K, and you have a morphism from K prime to K. So you can form the fiber product of G with K prime over K. And that's what we put here. Yeah, phi goes from K prime to K. Yeah, definitely. Yes. And so this, because we're, if you deal with groups, then you can just check it directly. For example, we need to prove that B prime is surjective. Well, how do you do it? Well, if you give yourself an element here, you map it down here, but this map is surjective. So there exists a something which maps onto the image here. So let me write it out maybe for once. So given X and K prime, there exists a G in G such that B of G equals phi of X as B is surjective. And then B prime of the pair X comma G comma X maps to X, and the pair G comma X lives in the fiber product because of this. So thus B prime is surjective. Similarly, it is obvious more or less that A prime, which now it's too high to reach for me, so the map A prime from H to G cross K prime over K, which was sending H to AH comma 1, is injective. Right? That follows immediately from A being injective. And so all we need to establish is that the kernel of B prime is equal to the image of A prime. Well, but what's the kernel of B prime? So first of all, we have if we have a pair G comma X in G cross K prime over K such that B of G comma X equals 1, B prime, sorry. In other words, that this pair lies in the kernel of B prime. Well, what's a map B prime? The map B prime is just the projection onto X. So this is the same thing as to say that X equals 1 in K prime. But this implies, because of the definition of the fiber product, that that B of G equals phi of 1, which of course is 1, which means that G is in the kernel of B, and that means by assumption that G is of the form A of H. Thus, we see that G comma X equals A of H comma 1, which is just A prime of H. And so we see that the kernel, that everything in the kernel is in the image, and that the image is contained in the kernel. Well, clearly, if you take B prime of A prime of H, well, then this is B prime of H, of A of H comma 1, and B prime is a projection onto the second factor, so this is 1. So, taken together, It follows that phi upper star of E is an exact sequence. There is a, as usual in this business, there is a dual construction. However, as you will notice immediately that for groups, It needs some care. So dually, assume we have given our extension E. And assume we are given now a homomorphism on the other side. Then we would like to form what's called the pushout of psi lower star of E. However, this will in general not work, except in case that H and H prime are abelian. So this is for H prime abelian. Namely, what we can take then here is simply we take G cross H prime divided by the subgroup, which is consists of AH, comma, psi of H. And then we get a diagram like this, where the morphism in the middle simply sends G to, so this is psi prime, which sends G to the class of G comma 1, and B prime is simply, so B prime sends a pair, the class of an element G H prime to B of G. And so, dually to what was said there, claim is that this is an exact sequence. And it's denoted by psi lower star of E. Now, here's the lemma, which says that the two operations commute. So we could, you see, over here, we pulled back the extension E by phi, and here we pushed it out by psi. So what we could do is we could first pull back E by phi and then push it out by psi, because the leftmost term in phi upper star of E is still H, so we could apply this construction to this case. And this is equivalent as an extension to the one where you do it the other way around. Now, I didn't say that here, but there's, of course, one more step to be done to be absolutely precise. Namely, you have to show that, or one shows that if E and E prime are equivalent, and remember what that meant. That meant you have an extension E, and say you have another one, E prime, with the same n terms, then they are equivalent if and only if you can fill in a diagram like this. And so the claim is, if E and E prime are equivalent, so are phi upper star E and phi upper star E prime, as well as psi lower star of E and psi lower star of E prime. So in other words, these operations of pullback and pushout are compatible with the equivalence relation. Now, what does this have to do with the question of determining all possible extensions of the Kleinian floor group by a group of order 2? Well, let's look at a special case, namely, let's say we start with phi, which is in the automorphism group of K. So then, So let me write it down as once again. So 1HGK, B and A. And then I claim that I can write down the pullback very easily. Namely, I claim that phi upper star of E is just going to be, has the same three terms, but here we'll take B followed by phi inverse. Now clearly, everything commutes. This one commutes without saying. This one commutes because phi is an automorphism, so we can form phi inverse, and then the composition here is just B. And so the claim is, so what's the claim? The claim is that this here is isomorphic to G cross K over K via these two morphisms, B and phi, and that we can find a diagram like this. So where this here is sort of the original definition of phi upper star of E. And now you see, so here we have two extensions which involve the same three terms. And the question becomes, are these two equivalent? So the question is, are E and phi upper star of E equivalent? And the answer is, in general, no. Because what would it mean? Well, to say that phi upper star of E is equivalent to E would mean that I would be able to write down the following. And I now have the identity here. Here the morphism is given. And I would need to find some morphism here, psi, that makes everything commute. Well, what does it mean? Well, first of all, of course, it means that psi A equals A. That's condition one. And so this makes the left square commute, and the second one is that I need to have that B psi equals phi inverse B. In other words, what it means is that the automorphism psi inverse of K, that I can lift it to G in such a way that it induces the identity on the subgroup. So now let's look at this in the context of the concrete example. So where we had H equals group with two elements and K the Kleinian four group. And so let's first note that the automorphism group of K is the symmetric group on three symbols. Right? Because group with four elements, you have the trivial element, and then you have three elements of order two, and how you name them doesn't matter. So you can permute them freely. So let's look at any extension. So this is the first thing. The second thing is, we know already that the group G has to have order eight. Why was that? Well, because the way we set the thing up and classified the extensions, we know that as sets, G is isomorphic to H cross K. And clearly, the set H cross K has eight elements. Now, if you look in any book on group theory, somewhere you are bound to find the exercise that the groups of order eight are the following. So you have three abelian ones, which are Z8, Z4 cross Z2, Z2 cross Z2 cross Z2, and you have two non-abelian ones, and they are the dihedral group of order 8, so this is the symmetries of a square. Rotational symmetries of a square. And all symmetries of a square. And you have the group 08, the quaternion group, plus minus 1, plus minus I, plus minus J, plus minus K. We already said last time that Z8 cannot occur in the middle because it's a cyclic group and any quotient of a cyclic group would be cyclic. So there are only four choices that could appear in the middle. And so here's the claim. So as H2 of V with values in Z2 contains exactly one extension with middle term Z2 cross Z2 cross Z2. It contains three times this group here, Z4 cross Z2. It contains three times the group D4, D8, and it contains exactly once the group 08. And these are the three orbits, these are the orbits under the automorphism group of V. In other words, these three occurrences, say, of the group Z4 cross Z2, they are permuted under the action of the automorphism group of V. So how do you see that? So let's assume we have an extension and let's call these maps A and B. Well, sort of the simple observation which will give it all away is the following, that the kernel of B has to contain all even elements. And so we'll just call that X or square. No, I shouldn't say even, all squares. Because I want to write the... So what does that mean? That means that if you have X and G, then X is a square. If there exists some Y and G, such that X equals Y squared. And clearly, if you have such a thing, then B of X is equal to B of Y squared is equal to B of Y squared, but all squares in here are trivial. Now, if you look through the list of the groups, then of the possible groups, then you see that Z4 cross Z2, so let's make a list of the groups. So here we have the groups, and here we have the squares in them. So if you start with Z4 cross Z2, then I claim that aside from 0, 0, there's only one further square. So we have 0, 0, and we have 2, 0. If you look at, well, Z2 cross Z2 cross Z2, there you have only 0 as a square. But if you look at D8, remember D8 can be written as, it's quite sort of as a group which is generated by rotation and a reflection with the property that S squared equals R fourth equals 1, and such that S times R equals R inverse times S. And so R is the rotation by pi over 2, and S is any reflection. And then the squares in here, well, of course, it's the identity element, which is always a square, and then it's R squared. Similarly, if you look at the quaternions of order 8, then you see that plus minus I, plus minus J, plus minus K, you can't extract the roots here, but squaring any one of these gives minus 1. So the squares here are plus minus 1. And what does that mean? That means that in these three cases, the morphism A is uniquely determined. There's nothing you can fudge with, because the image has to be the squares, and there are exactly 2 in each of these. So that means that the kernel of B is uniquely determined. However, I claim that for B, you have these choices. You can take B, or you can fudge it or modify it by an automorphism of this group over here, by an element from S3. And let's see why this makes a difference. Let's look at this case here. So if we look at Z4 cross Z2 modulo the kernel of B, and now I mean it as a concrete group, as cosets. So what do we have? What are the cosets? Well, there are, of course, 4 cosets, and how do they look like? Well, there is a coset where both components are even. This is the identity element, or the kernel. Then we have, well, let's say odd even. So this would be plus, minus, 1, and 0. Or we have even and odd. Or we have odd, comma, odd. Right? These are the 4 cosets that you have in this group. And now let's look at the order. Well, the order here, in this case, the order is 2. Well, this is just the kernel of B. Here, in this case, the order is 4. Right? Because any odd element in Z mod 4 has order 4. This one has order 2. Because it means it's 2 mod 4, and whatever it is in Z mod 2 has order 2. And similarly, this one has order 4. But now you see that even though as an abstract group, this is isomorphic to Z2 cross Z2, if you are looking for an automorphism here, it cannot exchange any class which contains elements of order 4 with a class that only contains elements of order 2, and is not trivial. So the only automorphism of Z2 cross Z2 that can be lifted is the permutation of the cosets with elements of order 4. So the stabilizer of an extension under the action of the permutation group is Z2, namely the one which interchanges these two. But if as soon as you start, for example, a cyclic permutation, then this cannot be lifted to the group up there. So thus, there are 3 inequivalent extensions with Z4 cross Z2 in the middle. Now, if you look at 08 in the middle, well, you see, where is the description of that group here? You see, 08 modulo the squares, that's just IJK are the three classes plus or minus. And of course, you can permute them. So here, gives 08 gives only one extension class. And if you look at D8, well, then you have the same similar analysis to this. Namely, if you look at the group D8, how does it look like? Well, you can write it, say, as 1 R squared R cubed, and then as SR squared SR cubed. These are the 8 distinct elements in the group D8, which is given by this presentation here. The squares, as we said, are just 1 and R squared, and so D8 modulo its subgroup of squares. Well, what are the congruence classes again? Well, the congruence classes is 1 and R squared, so this is a trivial one, the kernel. And then we have R and R cubed. And notice that any element in here has order 4, right? Because it's a rotation by pi over 2. What else do we have? Well, we have S and SR squared, but these are both reflections, so the order of each element in this coset is 2. And similarly, the last class is SR and SR cubed. And again, this consists entirely of reflections, so each element has order 2. And you see again that the only automorphism of the Kleinian 4 group which we can possibly lift is the permutation of the two classes that contain elements of order 4. But this class here, you cannot map to any of the other ones. There is no automorphism of D8 which would map an element of order 4 to an element of order 2. Cannot exist. So thus, again, D8 gives rise to 3 distinct extensions. And I'll leave the case where the middle is Z2 cross Z2 cross Z2. Well, maybe I should just make finally any extension with 3 copies of Z2 in the middle splits. That's clear, because what you have then is really a sequence of vector spaces over a field with 2 elements. And we know any sequence of vector spaces splits. So that's the first thing, and any 2 split extensions are equivalent. That's something one needs to write down once and for all. And so these 2 things put together imply that there exists just one extension with, well, one extension class with Z2 cubed in the middle. And so this finishes the proof of the claim, at least of this one, where we ignore the group action, that there are exactly 8 different extension classes, and where did I write it down, how they distribute? So there are Yeah, down here. So the trivial extension gives rise to one class, and in the group structure, this will correspond to the zero element. The two groups which had these distinction between elements of order 4 and 2, they occur each 3 times, and the quaternion group occurs exactly once. So you see that it is quite a bit more of information than just the term in the middle that is encoded in the theory of these extensions. So to maybe perhaps formalize it even a bit more, we can say it this way. Yes? Sorry? No, what I said, you see, I said that the construction of phi upper star does not need anything. H, G, and K can be anything. If you want to form pushouts because you want to get away, where was it? You want to get away with this construction, this will not work if H and H prime are not abelian. So for this one here, you need that H prime are abelian. But so we can say it in this way. So given H and K, and we look at the set of all extensions, just all exact sequences, and we assign to it the group G in the middle, what can we say about this map? Well, first of all, if we move to equivalence classes, so in other words, we look at the group H2KH, then, of course, if you have equivalences, that means that in the middle you have an isomorphism, so this will go to the isomorphism class of G. Let's call this G in brackets. And so we get a map from H2KH, map which you could call middle term, into the isomorphism classes of groups, and you can be even more precise, namely of order, if H and K are finite, of order of H times order of K. Moreover, this map factors through, you see you have the right action by the automorphisms of K, as I explained, and you have a left action by the automorphisms of H. Because what I showed you here for the action of the automorphism groups on the right-hand side, you can, of course, mimic on the left-hand side. Same, just a dual picture. So you get a map like this. And in our case, so in our example, this last map here, I'll call it pi is a bijection. Well, not actually, it's not a bijection, it's injective. But it misses the group Z8, right? That does not occur as an extension of Z2, of the Kleinian 4 group by Z2. In general, it's a very difficult problem to study this map. For example, it is a very difficult problem, and to my knowledge, there's no solution for it in general, saying what's the image. In other words, which groups of the proper order can be obtained, can be written as the extension of two given groups K and H. Same, this problem, it has nothing to do with group theory. You can ask this in a general context. For example, if you have a vector bundle over some space, you can ask yourself whether or not you can write it as the extension of two given bundles, assuming that the rank of the two adds to the rank in the middle. It's a legitimate question whether you can write it like this. And sort of a really curious problem where I think is almost nothing is known is, if you fix the middle term and ask yourself, in how many different ways can I squeeze it into the middle of an exact sequence? It has to do, but this is just sort of way beyond what we're going to talk about here, with stability questions. Right? Because the stability of vector bundles limits, at least gives you some information of what could potentially happen at the two outsides, if such a thing exists. And it's saying, stability is something like saying that it cannot occur in too many such extensions. So the worst case is where the middle term is simply the direct sum. Then there are too many ways of writing it as an extension, and that's sort of the worst case. So you try for something which has no real, has only a very small number of sub-objects or a small number of quotient objects, depending on how you look at it. Okay, any questions on this now extended example? But I thought it was a nice idea to do it all the way towards the end to show you in such a case where one can analyze completely just without any fancy theory, how the structure of the extensions encodes properties of the terms involved. Any questions here? Yes, I want to give you one example because it also is sort of a general principle that one can see very clearly how it works in this case. See, if you are interested in extensions, let's say, of this type, the question is, how could we produce interesting such examples? Well, one way of doing it is by using the pullback and pushout of exact sequences. For example, you can say, well, what kind of interesting group homomorphisms do I have on Z2 cross Z2? Well, not too many, right? I could look at the automorphisms, but I can also look, say, at just a map to Z2. Now, I know if I want to push out, I want to pull back from some extension here, well, the end here has to be the same as before. So what I'm just looking at is some extension of Z2 by Z2. But I know there is only one non-trivial extension of Z2 by Z2, and that is Z4. And I didn't say it, but phi upper star of a split extension is split, and so is psi lower star. So if I want to create something interesting, I better start with a non-split one. So I can form the fallback. I take some homomorphism, so chi, some group homomorphism, and I form the fallback. So obviously what this does is this, it creates a map from the extensions of Z2 by Z2, which I know there isn't too much. There are just there's just this one and the trivial one, so it has two elements, cross the homomorphisms. And of course, because it's abelian, whether I do it in the category of groups or abelian groups or Z-modules, whatever, Z2 cross Z2 to Z2, this is isomorphic to Z2 cross Z2 itself, and I get a map by simply taking a class, taking a homomorphism, phi, and assigning to it phi upper star of E, and this will give me an extension of this type. So, question is, if I do this, which of the extensions that we discussed do we get? Which ones are, as one says, induced by a character on the group at the right end? Sorry, here's we had chi. Let me write it like this. And here we had then chi upper star of E. Well, which ones do we get? Huh? We get all the abelian ones, yes, because the fiber product of three abelian groups is going to be abelian. So this is going to be abelian. And indeed, in this case, you get all the four abelian extensions. The trivial map, so where chi is 0, just gives you the trivial extension, which has Z2 cross Z2 cross Z2 in the middle. Doing this right? Because if this is a zero map, then what you have in the middle here is this cross the kernel of this map. Remember, the fiber product is the set of pairs of elements which go to the same here. But if this is a zero map, then what only thing you can take here are the things that map to zero. So just this times this. If you have a non-zero homomorphism, then you get exactly one of the classes, Z4 cross Z2. And which class you get depends on which one you single out as containing the element of order 4. Right? Remember the analysis of the extensions which have Z4 cross Z2 in the middle. This character chi, if you analyze the situation, tells you which of these elements here will contain the element of order 4. Which of the classes. So here we get, indeed, as a image here, we get all, so the image are the abelian extensions. Now let me use this to get at my other favorite exercise, where I said, what are the double covers, say, of S4? Remember, so by this I just mean all groups, sort of all groups, G with epimorphism onto S4, kernel of B of order 2. So how many such groups of order 48 are there? Well, if you have no clue, one thing you can say is, well, I could try to construct such a thing by using some homomorphism, say, into some nice group. Let's say into an abelian group. Well, how many different homomorphisms, or what are the homomorphisms from S4 to an abelian group? Well, we certainly know one, which is, say, the sign character. Right? You take a permutation and assign to it its sign. That gives you a map to the group with two elements. Now, the group with two elements extended by Z2 itself, again, as we know, there is only one non-trivial one. Thus, we get one of those groups simply by taking here the sign Z4 cross S4 over Z2 along this sign character. So this group here will fit the bill. How can you describe the elements, or how could you visualize this group? How would you describe to your friend this group in the middle? What is it saying? It is saying, let's take a permutation sigma. And here, let's, because S4 is non-commutative, so let's think of all these groups as being multiplicative. So we'll identify this as plus minus 1. So we'll have a sign plus minus 1 for a permutation. And then, of course, we should identify Z4 with plus minus 1 plus minus I. Right? These are just the fourth roots of unity. So what is this saying? This is saying these are consists of pairs, a fourth root of unity and a permutation, so that the square of this root is the same as the sign of the permutation. So in other words, I can write this group G here, I can think of it as being the set of elements, a square root of the sign of sigma times sigma. So where the square root of the sign of sigma sits in U4, so plus minus the fourth roots of unity, and sigma is in S4. So these are, in a sense, permutations together with the square root of the sign character. Exactly. That's why the group is twice as large, because you have two choices. Right? This gives you this map here picks out the corresponding square root you have chosen. So this here is two-valued, right? So if sigma is an odd permutation, if sigma is an even permutation, then you would simply have plus or minus sigma, because these are the square roots of plus 1. If sigma were an odd permutation, then the coefficient you have here is plus minus I, because these are the square roots of minus 1. And so, in these terms, so what is the group law? Or, equivalently, the co-cycle. Yes. But it is not a trivial extension, right? Yeah. So, this is a group of order 48, which is a double cover of S4. Yes. Yes. Okay, so Dror pushes our knowledge. So what Dror is saying, you can embed S4 into the rotations in 3-space. Namely, which group is this? The group of rotations, it's the rotational symmetries of... That everybody should know. If not, after today, you will know. It's the rotations of a cube, right? Or an octahedron, which is the same thing. Oh, because you want SO3. Because SU2 does not map, lies, gives a double cover of SO3. It's a double cover of SO3. But let's do it one step at a time. So S4 as a rotations in 3-space. That's the rotations of a cube or an octahedron. And so, well, if you are not too familiar with this, so how do you see SU2? For example, you can identify this with the quaternions of norm 1. Right? So this is a very speedy course through quaternions. Right? So the quaternions are, of course, A times 1 plus bi plus cj plus dk, where a, b, c, d are real. And I won't write down the multiplication between ij and k. If you don't know them, go to this bridge in Dublin where Hamilton carved them into the stone. So in here, if you have a quaternion x, then you can form its absolute value, which is simply a squared plus b squared plus c squared plus d squared. And h lower 1 is the set of all quaternions of norm 1. Well, actually, of course, the norm is the square root of this. But and so this is a group under multiplication, and it happens to be isomorphic to SU2. How do you get a morphism to SO3? Well, this is what Hamilton was really all about, right? Because why did he introduce the quaternions? He introduced the quaternions because he wanted to, a nice way to describe rotations in 3-space. So what you look at is you look at these so-called pure quaternions. And so this is the set of all quaternions whose real part, such that A equals 0. So the real part is, of course, the coefficient of 1. These are the real quaternions, the pure quaternions. And then H1 acts on H0 simply by conjugation. So you take a quaternion of norm 1, you take any pure quaternion and you assign to it x times v times x inverse, where x inverse, because the norm is 1, so norm equals 1 implies that x inverse is just the conjugate of x. In other words, it's a minus bi minus cj minus dk. And so what one checks is, so clearly the pure quaternions is the three-dimensional real vector space, by definition. And so one checks that this action is linear. This is more or less obvious. So it gets a map into GL3R. And moreover, it preserves the Euclidean distance or Euclidean norm. And so indeed, it factors through SO3. And it is surjective, and the kernel is plus or minus 1. Because, you see, if you take, say, minus 1, then the inverse is minus 1. That's in the center, so you have minus 1 v times minus 1. That pulls through, and you just get the identity. So, now we come back to Dror's remark. So we have SU2 equal to the quaternions of norm 1 maps onto SO3, and the kernel is just plus minus 1, so a group of order 2. So if you take S4, we can get some group. Okay. No, it's just the rotations of the cube.
But they're not orientation-preserving.
What? The rotations, by definition, are orientation-preserving. Yeah. For example, take the three space diagonals and look at the permutation. No, in a cube. You can collect these two points, and these two points. You get four space diagonals, and the rotations permutate them freely. That's four. What you're thinking of for the tetrahedron, the rotation group is A4, but if you take the full symmetry group, including the reflections, then you get S4. But then you don't get a double cover from SU2. So, but, hey, huh?
You can take the double cover from SU2
Not going to be surjective. No way. For example, O3 is not connected, and SU2 is connected.
No, but you can double it. I mean, you can.
Okay, so here's what Drawer is saying. So let's take S4. So this is usually also written as O, script O, because it's the symmetry group or the rotations of an octahedron or a cube. It doesn't matter. But people prefer the octahedron for some reason, and that's why this group in this representation is called O. And then the group you get here is called 2O. Because it's a double cover of this group. Is it this one, which we just described up there, or not? I agree there's another one. This one has order 48. It's a double cover of S4. Did we find one which we already saw, or is it a new one? How could we tell? I really like this, because this is one of the real-world questions you encounter when you start looking at this kind of stuff. Well, there's no other way than to dig deeper into the structure of the group in the middle. For example, how many elements of order 2 in this group G, in this one? How many are there? Huh? Are you just making this up, or are you serious? Okay. Well, which elements? So you see, sigma was a permutation on four elements. So how many permutations of order 2 do we have? Well, it's just the transpositions or the product of two disjoint transpositions, right? So transpositions, we have, well, we can exchange any two. So there are already six. Plus, we have three, which are products. So there are already nine in S4 of order 2. Now, I claim, and these are odd ones, right? No. So we have six. Okay. All right. Here we go. So you see, now we need to be really digging into the structure of the group to understand this picture. Yeah, so we have S4, the elements of order 2. So So we have IJ, and we have IJKL. So this one is, of course, odd. So it lifts to an element in G of the form plus minus I, I comma J. Right? Well, sorry for square root of minus 1. That won't work either. My alphabet is too small. Okay, so in the new group, these lifts, what's their order? It's 4, right? Because the square of this is going to be minus the identity. But here, these are even, and so they can be lifted to plus minus IJKL. And what's the order of such an element? So here the order is 4, and what's the order here? Well, if you take the square of this permutation and the square of this is both the identity, so the order here is 2. So we get at least 6 elements of order 2. Namely, these 3 things here, and then you can choose the sign. Now, where's Adam to ask him where his 7th element is? Right. Then we have, over here, we have these, so there are 6 of those. And then we also have minus the identity. Right. I was just asking you where the 7th element is, but we found it. All right. But here's the big question. How many elements of order 2 does this group have? If you have never seen this, it just has 1. Minus 1 is the only element of order 2 in here. The reason is that this group has only 1 element of order 2. Yes? So if you have X, say, the best thing to see it is in the quaternions. If you have a quaternion such that X squared equals 1, this implies that X equals plus or minus 1. And so because this this is a subgroup in here, this is a subgroup in here, because the pullback preserves monomorphisms. So this is a subgroup in here. So it can have at most 1 element of order 2. Thus, we see that 2O is not equal to chi upper star of S4. Sort of sine upper star is not equal to the sine upper star of the class Z2, Z4, Z2. And by the way, because it's a double cover of O, this is called the binary octahedral group. Binary because it's a double cover, and octahedral because this is the symmetry group of the octahedron. And you can do the same game. Take any symmetry group, rotational symmetries of a polyhedron, so of a solid, and take its double cover. And this double cover will have only 1 element of order 2. And so you get, for example, for the tetrahedron, if you look at the rotations of the tetrahedron, which is A4, you get 2 times the tetrahedral group, and you get, for example, the symmetry group of the icosahedron is A5, which is order 60. The binary icosahedral group is a group of order 120, which has exactly 1 element of order 2 in it. So, we found another one. So now we have three groups of order 48, which are double covers of S4. Right? We've got this one, and of course there's a trivial one. Just take the product. Now, you can, of course, combine them, because remember we said that H2 of S4Z2, this is a group, and it will be a group, a two-group. So it cannot have possibly just three elements. It must have more. So, that's right. Yes, so how do you combine the two things? Good question. So here we have found two constructions of a group of order 48, which doubles as a double cover of S4. Take the two and construct a new one. Well, that's, again, that leads to the addition of extensions. And that works in any abelian category. Or it works also in the category of groups. But only for extensions by abelian subgroups. Namely, assume you have given E1 and E2. Well, first of all, let's not be so picky. So let's say the first one is, and I'll do it for groups because it's, in a sense, it's the most complicated case, actually. So these are two exact sequences. Well, you will say, well, this is, what is he doing? This is totally obvious, right? I can take the product term by term. So I take H1 cross H2. I take G1 cross G2. I take K1 cross K2. And if this was A1, B1, A2, B2, of course, these are just the maps given component-wise. And clearly, if I start with two exact sequences, then this product of the two sequences is again exact. That's not a very exciting operation. However, assume that K1 equals K2. Then we have K cross K here. And so we can look at the diagonal from K, so let's call this K, from K into K cross K. So we can take delta upper star of E1 cross E2. This will reduce this piece here to K. So we just take the pullback. And we'll write it over here, somewhere over here. So we had H1 cross H2, G1 cross G2, K 1 cross K2, and so now we assume that this is product of the same group with itself, so we can take the diagonal, and we get some group, which I'll just call G, and the kernel is still the same. And so here we have a pullback. Now, of course, we have now too many groups, too much here, right? We just want one group instead of the two. So this, if you start with an extension, this here would be sort of, this is E1 cross E2, and this is delta upper star of E1. If you want to remember the K, delta K upper star of E1 cross E2. But now assume that H1 and H2 are the same, and they are abelian. So H1 equals H2, call it H, and it's abelian. Then the product of the two groups is the same as a direct sum. And so we have the sum map or the co-diagonal. Going to H. And so if we do that, if you push out, then we get a new group G prime. So we'll take the co-diagonal on H, upper lower star, the diagonal on K, upper star of E1 cross E2, and we get a new extension of K by H. And the class, so definition, the bare sum of extensions 1HG1 to K to 1 with H abelian and 1HG2 K to 1, call this E1, E2, is E1 plus one of, if you like, put his name down there, E1 plus E2 is defined to be what I just said, delta H, so the co-diagonal lower star, the diagonal on K upper star on E1 cross E2. And remember that upper star and lower star are exchangeable, so you could as well reverse the order in which you are doing this. So this is again an extension of K by H. So, exercise. What is the bare sum of 2O plus the extension induced from the sign character? Which group do you find in the middle there? And is it isomorphic? So what is really, is the middle term isomorphic to one of those we already know? That's the first exercise, and let me give you a second one. Two O is isomorphic to GO two F three. Right? So another concrete realization of the binary octahedral group is, as an abstract group, it is isomorphic to the invertible 2x2 matrices with entries in the field with three elements. So show. By the way, I don't know whether this is known by now or not, but at least I haven't seen it. It's an old question by Coxeter. To classify all groups which have exactly one element of order two. So there are some, like SU2, like SL2Z. So there are some classical matrix groups which have this property. But can one give a list of all of them? There is a relationship here because, for example, if you have a group, and now I have to try to remember this. I think last year there was an article by Milner in the notices of the AMS about actions of groups on spheres. And I believe to remember there is a theorem which says if you have a group which acts fixed point free on the sphere, then it can have only one element of order two. And very recent results on the sort of free actions of groups on spheres is a very old problem, and I believe it's only these groups that can occur. So the question is, which one are those? And so, for example, if you want to analyze this group here, would be a good idea, as we did here, to just look whether you can distinguish these groups by, for example, counting elements of order 2 or order 4 or whatever. Of course, one can go dig much deeper and can ask what are the pseudo subgroups of these things and so on. Okay, let's have a 10-minute break and then go on with explaining this construction a bit further and exploit it. This looked almost like rehearsed. Ask you the right question at the right point. Yes. is SL2. Okay, so change the second part of the exercise to show that these two groups are not isomorphic. Why? Because I said this one has exactly one element of order 2. This one has, of course, many more. Namely, you can take plus minus 1, 0, 0. There are already four elements of order 2, or 3, if you like. If you discard the identity. However, it still enters the picture because what's the order of GL2F3? Now, how do you do that? So if you have a finite field and you want to calculate GLN with a finite field, let's say F with Q elements, again, one of the things everybody should have seen once in their life. How do you get the order of this group? Very easy. Think of it as n by n matrices, and think of this, the column vectors are vectors in FQ to the power n. Now, a matrix is the same, an invertible matrix is the same thing as the basis of this vector space. So let's just count how many bases we can construct. Well, for the first column, we can certainly take any non-zero vector. So that means it's n times, it's q to the power n minus one element, because we cannot take the zero vector. So this is q to the power n minus one. This is the first column. Choice for the first column vector. And now for the second column, we need something which is linearly independent of the first. Well, that just means it cannot lie on the line spanned by the first vector. The line spanned by the first vector has q many elements, right? Because we have q scalars. So the second one, we can choose q to the n minus q. And the third vector, we can take anything which is not in the plane spanned by the first two. But the plane has q squared many elements, so we get qn minus q squared. This is the third column. Choices. And now we have n column, so the nth column. So what should I put here? So it's q to the n minus q to the n minus 1. Right. We have a hyperplane already accounted for by choosing the first n minus 1 vectors, and so there are q to the n minus q to the n minus 1 many choices left. And that's it. That's the order of this group. Okay, now because we are at it, what is the order of SLN FQ? So determinant 1. Well, the determinant is a group homomorphism from GLN to the units of FQ. How many units are there? There are Q minus 1. So this is the same as the order of GLN FQ divided by Q minus 1. Good. So let's see. GL2F3. So how many elements do we have? Well, the first choice, we have 9 elements in the plane over a field with 3 elements. We can take 8 vectors, any non-zero vector. And then the second choice, we can take anything of the 9 points except what's on the line spanned by the first vector. So that's 9 minus 3, which is 6. So the order of this group is 48. So the order is okay. Now what's the determinant? Well, the determinant goes to to F3 star, which is of course a group with 2 elements. So SL2 F3 has 24 elements. So now the question, of course, is GL2F3 a double cover of S4 or not? Well, first of all, what is the I claim there is a distinguished subgroup here of order 2. Namely, what's the center? If you look at the center of GLNF, any field, what's the center? Probably everybody did in linear algebra. It's just the F star, so the non-zero elements times the identity matrix. And of course, because it's a center in particular, it's a normal subgroup. So it's normal. And so you get GLNF. Here you get the center. And what do you call the quotient? That's PGLNF. That's the projective general linear transformations over the field F. And so you see, we said the order, so for F equals F3, the orders were 2, and it's a central subgroup. And remember, we were looking at for central extensions. Here we had this one, so order 2. This one had order 48, and this one then obviously has order 24. Now I claim that this one, this was for n equals 2 and f equals f3. So I claim that PGL 2F3 is isomorphic to S4. Why is that? Oh, it's a very simple geometric argument. Namely, how can you, probably most of you haven't seen this group before, but what you have seen before, I'm pretty sure, is this one. The projective general linear groups on the complex plane. Namely, what is this? What is this group? Wherever you take a course of complex variables, this one will appear. This is the group of Möbius transformations. Or general linear fractional transformations. Namely, you can think of it also as saying this consists of the maps Z goes to AZ plus B over CZ plus D, where AD minus BC is not zero. And you see the map from GL2 is simply the map which you take the matrix A, B, C, D, and you map it onto this map there. Clearly, the kernel, if you have a diagonal matrix where A equals D, well, then you see that B and C are zero, and so A and D cancel. So you get the same map. So the kernel has definitely the center in its kernel. And this holds for any field. So you can PGL 2 for any field F, you can think of as being the set of maps Z goes to AZ plus B over CZ plus D, where A, B, C, D is an element in GL 2 F. However, what is it a map of? Where does Z range over? Well, clearly you can plug in any element from F. However, you might have to divide by zero, right? Because CZ plus D could be zero. So you have to join a point at infinity. So this is F union infinity, and this one then lies in F union infinity. Or, in more fancy terms, this is a projective line over F, and so you should think of this as being a map of the projective line to itself. Now, if you do this with F3, how many points does the projective line over F3 have? Four, right? So, in other words, PGL2F3 definitely maps to S4, because you just record how this map transforms the four points, F3 plus infinity, 0, 1, 2 plus infinity, among themselves. And, as you might also remember from the theory of Möbius transformations, the group of Möbius transformations is triply transitive. If you're given three points, three distinct points, and another three distinct points, there is a unique morphism, Möbius transformation, which maps this ordered set of three points to the other ordered set of three points. And that's true over any field. So PGL2F is always triply transitive. The proof is the same as over the complex numbers. Just solve this quadratic system of equations. But that means that over F3, I can take my point 0, 1, 2, and I can map them to any three others that I prescribe arbitrarily. But then the fourth point maps to the only point which is left over. So it is a permutation, and any permutation can be realized. So this is, in a nutshell, the proof that these two groups are the same. And so here we have then, if you check all these details, so then we have indeed another. So we get 1 to F3 the units, which is Z2 or mu2, to GL2 F3 to PGL2 F3, which is S4. And this sits in the center, so it is one of those. So we can think of this as being a class in H2, S4, Z2. Now, of course, the question is it one of the two groups we had seen earlier? Is it the binary octahedral group, or is it the one which you get by pulling back the sign representation? And that I leave as an exercise. But as Adam was saying, just look at the number of elements of order 2 in these various groups to figure out whether they can or cannot be isomorphic. Okay. So, maybe to so coming back to general extensions, and now yes, because sorry, say this. There are some? Yes, they are the same. So the group structure on the extension is given on the level of co-cycles by multiplication of co-cycles. On the level of group extensions, it's given by the bare sum. Yes, so that's, of course, an important fact. So theorem So multiplication or addition, depending on how you write your group, of cocycles corresponds to their sums of extensions. So let me get back now to extensions in abelian categories. Unfortunately, for groups, for the category of arbitrary groups, not necessarily commutative, there is no good theory of higher extensions. And in general, it is a big problem of what you do in categories which are not abelian, like groups, but where you still have the notion of extensions. How do you classify them, and how do you develop the theory that I'm just going to show you now, and which I outlined sort of in a nutshell last time without going into too much detail. So, we'll fix an abelian category, let's say A, and we'll say, an extension of x by y, where x and y are objects of A, is the short exact sequence zero goes to y, goes to z, goes to x, with A equals the kernel of B and B equals the co-kernel of A. And just as a reminder, so any morphism F from U to V in A gives rise to two exact sequences namely we have U, V, F. Here we have the image of F. Here we have the kernel of F. And here we have the co-kernel of F. And this sequence is exact, and this sequence is exact. And so that's why, for abelian categories, it is essentially equivalent whether you study morphisms or you study short exact sequences. So, just to formalize it, so two extensions E 0 to Y to Z to X to 0 and E prime 0 to Y to Z prime to X to 0 are equivalent if there exists a morphism phi from Z prime to Z such that the diagram let's call this A, B, A prime, B prime, so such that phi A prime equals A and B phi equals B prime, i.e. the squares above commute. And so x1 in the category A of x to y is by definition the set of all sequences 0, y to z to x to 0, modulo the equivalence relation. Now, again, I'm just ignoring set theory. Why is this a set? No reason, right? Because, I mean, I fixed two objects, but there's no real restriction a priori of what could happen in the middle. Why should the things that can appear form a set? So you have to be careful. So again, we're running against possible set theoretic trouble. Unless, of course, we know that our abelian category is small. So unless A is small. Now often you have some external reasons that give you that the extensions of two objects will be a set. But it's not a given. So I'm just saying that this is sort of a lax description of what it is. So, lemma, if F from X prime to X is any morphism, then for any extension E as here, F upper star of E given by 0 goes to Y goes to Z cross X prime over X to X prime, where this here is the second projection and this here is the map given by A prime is an extension of X prime by Y. Moreover, F upper star of equivalent extensions yields equivalent extensions. That is, F upper star defines a map from X1 A XY to X1 A X prime Y. Now, I was hesitating when I wrote down this map A prime, so we'll need to prove a few things. And I'm going to prove this. So, we are given our extension E, and I call this Z prime, just to a short. So the claims here are, so Z prime is by definition the fiber product of Z with X prime over X. This map here is a second projection. And so there are two claims, or several claims here. The first claim is that the second projection is an epimorphism. The second claim is, if you look at the left square here, that in what it really says is there exists this map A prime, there exists isomorphism A prime from Y to Z prime such that, let's call this F prime, such that F prime A prime equals A, and that's it, yeah. Well, the third claim is that A prime is the kernel of the second projection, and the second projection is the co-kernel of A prime. So that then, taken together, says, first of all, point 2 says that we can write down this map A prime, and point 1 and 3 together say that this is, again, an extension. So now let's see. So let's prove that the second projection is always an epimorphism in any abelian category. So how do we do that? Well, for this, we recall how we can construct a fiber product in an abelian category. So recall that Z prime can be obtained as follows. As a kernel where we put the product here, or because we are in an abelian category, the product and co-product is the same, so we take Z plus X prime goes to X, goes to 0, where the map from here to here on Z, it's just the given map B, and on X prime, it's minus the map F. Right? Remember, we said in general we could take the fiber product as being the equalizer of the two maps B and F, but because we are in an abelian category, sort of the equalizer of B and F is the same as the kernel of B minus F. And if you really want to, perhaps I should be slightly less flippant here and I should write out this map in more detail. So this is B composed with the inclusion into the first summand minus F composed with the inclusion of the second summand. Right? So where the inclusion, the first inclusion is a map from Z into Z direct sum X prime, and the second inclusion is a map from X prime into Z plus X prime. So moreover, claim that no. Yeah, you're right. Yes. Sorry. Okay. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. So now, how do we prove okay, let me first prove step 2. So why does Y map through Z prime? Well, that can be seen immediately from here because you see you have Z plus X prime, you have this map to X, and here you have Y, and you have the map from A into the first, the map A into the first component, and then the zero map into the second component. Now, if you compose it with this map here, well, then you get the composition will be BA minus F0. But BA is equal to 0 because this was an exact sequence to begin with. This one is, of course, 0 because any composition with a 0 morphism is 0. So in other words, this morphism is 0. But that means that this morphism here factors uniquely through Z prime, because Z prime is the kernel of this map here. Right? So Z prime as Z prime equals the kernel of Z plus X prime goes to X. So and the uniqueness follows, of course, from the fact also that so this is a map A prime in step two, the one which comes from this diagram here. Okay, so for example, in step three, why is A prime the kernel of this map here? Well, remember what this means. This means so if I look at the extension down here, what do I have to show? I need to show that whenever I have a morphism, call it G, such that this composition is zero, then there exists a unique morphism here. That's the definition of the kernel of this map here. Anything that maps here and goes to zero indeed factors through this, and even uniquely. Now, but this is just a simple exercise because you see, if you look at the composition here, so we know that the second projection with G is zero. That's the assumption. But this implies, of course, that if you go all the way down here, that F prime, that B F prime G, which is the same as F composed with the second projection with G, is equal to zero. So in other words, if you go all the way here. But this means that there exists a unique map here. But this means there exists a unique map, whatever Shema call it, G tilde from U to Y, such that A times G tilde is equal to F prime and G. Now, of course, because here we have the identity, so the claim is now, of course, that this implies that A prime G tilde is equal to G. And that should follow from what we already did. Where did we write it down? Because you see, F prime Yeah. So if you take, if you apply F prime to this, then we get that F prime A prime G tilde is equal to F prime G, but F prime G is A G tilde. Okay. Oh. To prove that A prime G tilde is equal to what I want. A prime G tilde is equal to G, right? I didn't prove that yet. I just claimed that. Sorry. So how do we prove that? Well, the only thing we need to do, because that prime is the pullback of this diagram, we need just to see that G and A prime G tilde give the same maps when mapped to Z and to X prime. Right? Because this is the pullback. So if we have Z goes to X goes to X prime, what is a map to Z prime from U? Well, that's the same thing as a pair of maps from to these two corners such that the outer diagram commutes. And then there exists a unique morphism here. So now let's do this first for G. Well, if you take G, and here we had the second projection, this was zero. That was the way we set it up. If you go here, then this map here is F prime G. And this goes, so the outer square commutes because this diagram here commutes, right? Because we have F composed with the second projection is equal to BF prime. So now if we look at the map we want, so we look at A prime G tilde, here. Look, say G is this, and here we have A prime G tilde. So we just simply need to convince ourselves that if we compose with the second projection here, we get zero. If we compose with this projection here, we get F prime G. And that's what I think we already hopefully did. Do. So let's see. So why is it true that F prime A prime G tilde is equal to F prime G? Well, that was because of what we established earlier, that F prime A prime is A, and the way we chose G tilde, right? G tilde was chosen so that it satisfies this. So that means that this piece of the diagram commutes, and that this piece of the diagram commutes is simply saying that this composition here is zero. That's because of the uniqueness, it must follow that G is equal to A prime G tilde. And that gives us which step? So that gives us this piece here. So we have done this, we have done this. This is done by same argument just on the other side. And so, yes, why is this projection onto X prime an epimorphism? Now, if these were sort of abelian groups or modules, it's clear, right? Then we have seen this argument already. We have said, well, if you have an element in here, how do we find a pre-image? Well, we simply take this element, map it down here. This map is surjective, so it has a pre-image, and so take this element plus this pre-image, and that defines something in the probec. And so this one is surjective. So one can also give a sort of one is clear for sets. Now convert this proof into a diagram. Often, it is always enough to argue for sets, but this is sort of cheating. I think it's cheating. One really should try first to prove this just from the axioms. But just so that give you an what some people say, well, then why do we bother with abelian categories to begin with? But so here's an aside. And that's a theorem that many people, Gabriel Mitchell, Fried, looked in. And that says any abelian category A embeds as a full subcategory into a module category where E is some ring. Moreover, the embedding is exact. And what does that mean? That means that an exact sequence in A is exact if and only if it is exact in the category of modules, i.e., 0 to Y to Z to X to 0 in A is exact if and only if it is exact in mod E. What this, as a practical consequence, this theorem says that whatever you can do in linear algebra, you can do in an abelian category. Because if you don't know how to handle it, you just take the question you have in A and you interpret it as a question on modules. And then questions on modules and exact sequences of modules, that's linear algebra. No? You disagree? Okay. No, not with my view. Module theory is linear algebra over a ring. Okay. So, but let me come back to this. So what we have seen now is, with at least parts of the proof, how you pull back an extension. The dual picture is how to push out an extension, and because the notion of an abelian category is self-dual, I don't really have to say anything about it. So similarly, so given G from Y to Y prime, we can, and the same extension E as before, we can form G lower star of E, and so I'll write it down just for good measure. So here we have 0, Y to Z to X to 0, A and B. Here we have the morphism G to Y prime. And so what we do is we take Z plus Y prime, divide out by Y. So you can think of this as being this one here, which I call, maybe I call it again, Z prime. So Z prime is simply the co-kernel of the map which has component A into Z and G into Y prime. And so the co-kernel, that's just the quotient by this morphism here. And so this here is E, and this is G lower star of E. And again, this is compatible with equivalence. Thus, we get a map G lower star from X by Y into in over in A to X in A X Y prime. Now, these two constructions, the pullback and the pushout, and I said this is X1, are compatible in the sense that you have, so if you have, say, G from Y to Y prime and G prime from Y prime to Y double prime, then you have that G prime lower star, G lower star of E is equivalent to G prime G lower star of E. So in other words, pushing it out in stages or pushing it out all the way, that's the same thing. Similarly, if you have F from X prime to X and you have F prime from X double prime to X prime, then first applying F upper star and then F prime upper star to E results in an equivalent extension as taking the composition and pulling back. And this is really nothing but the transitivity of the pullback, respectively the transitivity of the pushout. If you push out twice, you could do it along the composition once. So thus, we see that X1A becomes a bifunctor on A up cross A. And the fact that it is the contravariant argument, you see, it becomes a contravariant functor because it switches the order. Right? You go backwards. If you take pullbacks, you go backwards. So that is the functoriality, and the second next statement is sort of another way of stating what we did at the very beginning today, namely assume that A is a K category. In other words, let's assume that our morphism sets are not just abelian groups, but they are K modules over some ring K. Then K acts on X1, A, XY, and all possible actions you can imagine are the same. Namely, you see, if you have 0, y, z, x to 0, to say that you have a k-linear structure means that, let's say, we pick an element x and k, there is multiplication by x, well, on x, there's a multiplication by x on z, there's a multiplication by x on y, so this is E, A and B. So this commutes. This is part of the, just to say that it is a K category. Moreover, we have that MX of X upper star of E is equivalent, again, to MY of X lower star of E. So it doesn't matter whether you take the top and pull it back by multiplication on the right side, or you start at the bottom and push it out on the bottom side. And it's quite instructive to actually to understand how this works. So I beg your pardon for doing the pedagogically unsound by removing the middle arrow here. And I just want to draw in this one. So if you take the top and pull it back by this morphism here, well, then we get some exact sequence here. So we can think of this exact sequence as mx of x upper star of E, where this here is the pullback. Similarly, I can start by pushing out Now, because I had already a morphism in the middle here, namely mz of x, this induces a morphism in the middle by just using the universal properties of the push-out and of the pullback. So mz of x induces uniquely a morphism from z double prime to z prime, such that, of course, everything here commutes. So let's call this mu, such that, so if you call this mu here, mu A equals A prime, no. This should be something else, right? It's A double prime, and here, I'm really sorry for doing this. So if we had started here, A prime, B prime, and here and have double prime, so we have that mu A double prime equals A prime, and B prime mu equals B double prime. In other words, you see, this extension through Z prime, that's the pullback along X. The extension with Z double prime in the middle is the push out by MY, but the existence of the morphism in the middle just says that the two are equivalent. So that's mu yields an equivalence from my of x lower star of E to mx of x upper star of E. And of course, we simply call the class of either of these two x times E. So this is the class of X, X times the class of E is the class of either of the two. MY of X lower star
of E, etc.
So that's where the K structure comes from. Now, of course, I didn't tell you what the addition is, but we saw it already earlier for the groups, and it's the same here. But why did I choose to do the K-linear, so the scalar multiplication first? Because in particular, one gets minus E. Because any abelian category has a Z structure. And so how can you see minus E? Well, there are many ways of doing it, but so if you are given an extension, then I claim that any of the following represents minus E. Namely, you can choose to put the minus sign wherever you like. Or of course, you could take minus 1 on X, upper star of E, or you could take minus 1 on Y, lower star on E. All gives the same extension. No, because you see, for example, this one, how would you get this? This one you get by taking minus multiplication by minus 1 on X and taking the pullback. It's the same as what we said at the beginning. So here, this is an isomorphism, and the equivalent class you get is by this one. But set theoretically, for example, this thing here is something else than this. So they are not the same. They're only isomorphic or equivalent. Right? I mean, a priori, the construction of these various things is different. So, sorry, let me remove this. For example, how do you see that it doesn't matter where you put the minus sign? Well, we need to show that these two are equivalent. Well, that's easy, right? Just take the identity here and put minus 1 here. Then both squares commute. And so you see it doesn't matter where, on which side you put the minus sign. So in this sum, so given E and E prime extensions of X by Y, well, I just have to repeat what I said earlier. We'll define the sum of the classes to be, well, remember, we take sort of the external sum of the two exact sequences, taking direct sums of the corresponding terms. We take the diagonal on X upper star to make the right end reduce it from X cross X to X, and we take the co-diagonal on Y lower star to reduce it from Y plus Y down to Y. And this is the bare sum of E of the two classes and E prime. And again, of course, one needs to check that this construction is compatible with equivalences, but this is just really drawing some diagrams. And so the theorem is then that X1 A takes its values in the category of K modules. So if A is a K category, abelian K category. So if you have K acting as scalars on all the morphism sets, then it acts also on the extension groups. And X1 and this functor is bi-additive. In other words, you have that X1 of X1 plus X2 comma Y is canonically isomorphic to X1, X1, Y plus X1, X2, Y, etc. And similarly for the other argument. So this deals with the X1 part. But you're going to ask, well, okay, so what? Well, here's a key point. Given any exact sequence, and now I just want to go away from the XYZ, just take any exact sequence, and some object X in A. So A and B. Then I can look at, apply Hom from X to this. Now what happens is that you get an exact sequence of abelian groups or even K modules if you have a K category. 0 goes to Hom A, X comma A goes to Hom A, X comma B goes to Hom A, X comma C, and the morphisms here, you see, this is just composition with A, and this is composition with B. Right, so you have a morphism from X to A, say F, and then you can compose it with A to go to B, and so F here goes to AF, and similarly G here goes to BG. Now the statement is, this is exact. However, in general, it is not surjective. This last morphism is not surjective. Even though this sequence is exact, you see, if I have a morphism from X to C, so something in here, what would it mean that it's in the image? It would mean that I could factor it through some morphism beta. And that's normally not okay. I can't do it. So in general, it's not exact. However, I know precisely, well, sort of, what is a failure of surjectivity. Namely, I can put here X1, A, X comma A, and I can continue into X1, A, X comma B, and I can even continue one further into X1, A, X comma C, where I'll describe this map in a second, and this one here is simply A lower star, and this one is B lower star. Now, A is a morphism from A to B, so I can take an extension class of X by A and push it out along A. Similarly, I can take an extension class and push it out along C. And what's delta? Well, what can delta be, possibly? Look at this diagram. I have an exact sequence to start with. I have a morphism from X to C. Well, what I, of course, do, this here is simply upper star. In other words, if I have a morphism F here, I'll take, map it to F upper star of this given exact sequence. And so this is what the real importance of these extension groups is. They measure to what extent the hum fails to be exact, to reproduce surjectivity, epimorphisms. And sort of the surprising thing is that in any abelian category, as you saw, we didn't use any particular properties, you can measure the failure of this lifting property. Now, we said to say that this one would be surjective would mean we take a morphism F and we factor it through B. We lift through B. And what's the failure of doing so, to be able to do so? Well, it lies here in this extension class, and it is given by the pullback of this exact sequence. Now, why is this so? And I realize that I forgot to tell you one important, very important thing. Namely, what's the zero element? The zero element in x1, a, xy. Well, that's just the byproduct. In other words, it is, remember, the exact sequence which comes equipped with these two morphisms in the other direction. And so, if you grant me that, then it is clear what happens. Namely, and it makes clear why this X group appears there as an obstruction or allows us to extend the sequence further. Namely, you see, if we construct F upper star, so we started with a given exact sequence, we'll take F upper star of E, which is simply this sequence. Now, what does it mean that this sequence splits? So what would it mean that F star E equals zero in X1 XA? Well, that means that I have a morphism, whatchamacallit, J, or S for section, here, such that B prime S equals the identity on X. Because this would say, to say that this one is trivial means it's a direct sum, so B prime admits a section. But then you see, it follows that G, that beta equal F prime S lifts F through B, right? Because if I apply, if I take B beta, then this is equal to B F prime S, Well, BF prime, by definition, is FB prime. F, but F is a section of B prime, so this is F. So, if the pullback splits, that's the same thing as to say that I have a lifting. Conversely, the converse works as well, namely, assume I have a map beta which makes this upper triangle commutative. In other words, such that B beta equals F. Well, so conversely, if there exists a beta from X to B such that B beta equals F, then you get S is a unique morphism from X to this, fiber product, which has a property that if you restrict to B or to X, that from X to B it is beta, and from X to X it's the identity. These commute over C, thus there exists S. So it's the same thing to say you have a splitting here, or you have a lifting of F through B. And that means precisely all of this together means that exactness, we have exactness at hum A X C. If we have a morphism F which goes to zero, then it comes from a morphism from X to B, and if it came from a if the map was a composition with B, in other words, if there was a beta, then the pullback splits. And now, the other ones, exactness at the other places is pretty straightforward. There's nothing really deep, but the crucial thing is this connecting homomorphism there. And it is really this which is at the basis of the notion of a triangulated category. Because what is the point here? The point is, well, we started from A, B, C. Happened to be an exact sequence. But whenever we apply a functor to it, like such as hum X, then we get sort of another morphism here, free, namely this connecting homomorphism. So the philosophy behind the triangulated categories is that this morphism is already there. We just, to make it enter the real world, we need to apply a functor to this sequence. Because this is not, delta is not a morphism in the abelian category A. It only appears once you apply a functor to it. However, the idea then of a triangulated category is to say, to incorporate this as part of the structure. And so instead of dealing with short exact sequences, you want to deal with triples. And now you see, because there's sort of this recurring pattern, you go from A to B to C to A, and then from A to B to C again. So that's why you think of this as a triangle. This delta really goes back to the beginning. And so the real jump from abelian categories to derived or triangulated categories is this step, to enlarge the exact sequences formally by this third morphism, which should be there, but which you can only see after you apply a functor. Okay, but next time, as I said, next Monday I'm not here, but then the week thereafter, I'm going to finish the X. For example, what happens if one interchanges the role? So if one doesn't apply hom X, but one applies hom question mark X. Now, of course, because everything should be self-dual, I can't even leave it to you to write down what should happen then. And I will also comment quickly on the higher X groups, sort of the n-fold extensions, and very importantly, how can one calculate these groups? Because as you saw in the simple example of extension of the Kleinian 4 group by Z2, you certainly would not want, in general, to sit down and write down all possible extensions without even knowing where you're, what you're looking for. So is there, in other words, a good way of calculating these groups? And the answer is, in linear algebra, that is, in the module categories, there is. In geometry, there is sort of, but in general, there is not. Okay, thank you.